to reconvene the public hearing on House Bill 2427. We are the House Ag and Natural Resources Subcommittee this evening. And this is Tuesday, March 19th, 2013. We are in session. Welcome back, everyone. Certainly appreciate everyone coming back this evening. I recognize, as do the other committee members, that this is undoubtedly an inconvenience for many of you. For that, I apologize, but we greatly appreciate the fact that you're here and participating in the public process. Thank you for that. The first folks that I'm going to call up will be Greg Loberg and Bob McReynolds, please. Good evening, gentlemen, and
good
welcome.
Evening.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks for reconvening the subcommittee.
Absolutely.
Chair Witt and subcommittee members, I'm Greg Loberg. I am here as the Public Relations Chair of the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association, and I also manage West Coast Beet Seed Company here in Salem. I will say just a little bit about parts of my written testimony. I'll try not to speak too much from notes, and I'll try to address some things that were covered this morning, some of it in great detail and much of which overlaps my testimony. So you've got my testimony, I hope, in front of you or available to you otherwise. The WVSSA has existed formally since 1980 and for decades prior to that. Membership in the association is required in order to participate in a mutually beneficial mapping system, and that is what we are most known for, and I guess now we're also known for coming to public hearings. I will talk about a couple of things that I view as perceptions that I think are misperceptions, and so while talking about the mapping and isolation system and membership to the WVSSA, a very little production of seed in specialty crops is contracted outside of our current membership. We are 36 members strong, and we keep adding to that number. Much of what I'm going to call legacy turnip production, publicly owned varieties of turnips that have been grown by individual farmers in the past, have now come under our mapping system. Similarly, one of the popular crops these days is cover crop radish, or tillage radish it's called. Much of that production is also pinned, mapped, and stewarded by our association. So as we heard this morning in several different ways, the authority of the ODA to regulate in some fashion rapeseed or canola began with 1989 legislation, and the first production districts were established in 1990. By 2005, what were called control areas were put into place, the outcome being that rapeseed or canola could be grown in the Willamette Valley only by special permit. That was a good move, in our opinion, by the Department of Agriculture. Countries in Western Europe who did not follow that type of proactive approach to canola wound up losing their seed production areas, and again, we heard about that this morning. What I would like to do to frame this up in terms of economics is to say that although it's not a statistically verifiable number, the farm gate value of specialty seed in 2012 is about $50 million by our estimates. Clover seed in 2012 is about a $30 million farm gate industry. Grass seed, about $300 million, give or take. It's been closer to $500 in the heyday of the real estate cycle of the last few years, and it's been less than that. So those three seed sector areas, along with fresh market vegetable crops, amounts to about a $400 million industry. Some percentage of that industry is at risk if canola is introduced into the Willamette Valley. And so I would compare some percentage of $400 million to, give or take, $2.5 million worth of canola. And we think that it has been a good decision by the Department of Ag, therefore, to make sure that specialty seed and all seed crops are defended against this particular crop and the invasive nature that it has in other seed crops and in vegetable food crops. In the case it's not obvious in terms of grass seed and clover, canola would expand the potential to contaminate those crops and make it more difficult to ship those crops out of state or out of country. So the rule that was amended in, I didn't know there was a time limit.
I apologize. I neglected to make that announcement.
Could I have 1 minute instead of 15 seconds?
We'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you. The objections that we have to the newly adopted rule is that ODA has proceeded to amend their own longstanding rule without new data. They have not presented new data in 2005, 9, or 12. The rules that have been put in place have some stewardship pieces to them, but these are not funded. Instead, as we heard this morning, the funding is based on cost recovery. We think that recovering the costs after the damage has occurred is far too late. And finally, the department has been unable to reverse any of the concerns previously expressed in other rulemaking years. So I will conclude there and urge you to support House Bill 2427.
Thank you very, very much. And for the record, it is approximately 6:08 p.m., and I'm gaveling in the House Ag and Natural Resources full committee. Thank you very much. Welcome, sir.
Chair Witt and legislative members of the committee.
3 minutes.
That's a challenge indeed for such a critical issue, but I'll do my best. My name's Bob McReynolds. My address is 1195 Clayton Way, Gladstone, Oregon. For the past 30 years, I've served as an OSU Extension agent with responsibility for extension programs for vegetable and specialty seed growers in the Willamette Valley. I retired in 2010. Since then, I've been working part-time in the same position with the same responsibilities. My current title is Associate Professor Emeritus Horticulture Extension. Most of the discussion we heard during the informal meeting this morning, informational hearing this morning, focused on the potential impact of canola seed to specialty seed crops in the valley. Unfortunately, other specialty crops, such as vegetables, of which there are many in this valley, have not received a respectable amount of attention in any of the oil canola seed discussions. This current rule is designed to protect brassica seed crops. There is no spatial protection for food brassica crop growers. However, the impact of canola on many vegetables will be just as devastating as it will be on specialty seed crops. I'll begin my testimony with a quote from this book. You have the citation. Recently in Europe and parts of Asia, greater production of agricultural oilseed brassicas, rapis oilseed primarily, has increased the incidence of some brassica pests and pathogens on horticultural crops. This situation is exacerbated as the economic threshold for damage caused by pest and pathogens on oilseed rape is higher than for horticultural brassicas, and therefore less control is used. Consequently, larger pests or pathogen populations can develop in oilseed rape in the absence of control and then move en masse onto horticultural crops with devastating consequences. Overwintering oil rapeseed provides a substantial green bridge for the fungal disease light leaf spot and in consequence is a major foliar disease of that crop. In turn, rape provides a reservoir of infection that transfers onto vegetable brassicas and can cause appreciable loss of quality to leaf types. I'd like to point out that book was published in 2007, and as you know, it takes time to publish books, especially research publications like this one, because the information must be validated. So that means that everything that was included in this book, the data to support it, were collected prior to 2007. The quote documents the impact of oilseed canola on high-value specialty horticultural crops, specifically brassica vegetables. There's three terms that come out of this book, out of that quote, that I'll focus on in my upside-down 15-minute seconds. Chair Witt and members, I would ask for just an additional 2 minutes.
Sir, if I do that, in fairness, I'm going to have to offer it to everyone, and I won't get through the hearing tonight. I apologize.
All right. Well, the three words which this discussion really needs to revolve around for everybody from this point on is quality, quantity, and thresholds. Horticultural commodities that we're talking about quality. They must meet quality standards, and that's expensive. There's costs for herbicides, insecticides, and fungicides. Quantity is the difference between what canola is and our high-value vegetable crops. The difference is that canola does not have a quality factor. It has a quantity. It's based upon quantity. The issue for the difference is the thresholds at which we must treat in canola for the pathogens and insects that occur and their ability to transfer into horticultural commodities.
Thank you.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. I certainly appreciate that. Committee members, any questions or comments for this panel? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. All right, next I'd like to, and folks, just by way of explanation here, if we're going to get through tonight, there's enough folks that I'm going to have to limit your testimony to 3 minutes. I would suggest for those of you who don't do this on a regular basis, if you jot down on a piece of paper the key points that you want to make, it'll make it easier for you, trust me. It'll make it easier for you to do it within 3 minutes. Why you either support the bill or oppose the bill. And please add any new information. If it's stuff that we've already heard, you can say, I support the earlier comments on. That takes you 5 seconds, and you can actually get more information on the record. 3 minutes, and I'm going to try and alternate as best I can between for the bill and against the bill. As we go on, it becomes increasingly difficult for me to balance that, but I'm going to try to do the best job I can. Bear with me. We're going to try and be as fair as possible. So next will be Troy Hadley, Chuck Sherman, and Joseph Sherman. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hello.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you for allowing us to be here. Go ahead and start.
Yes, and please identify yourselves for the record.
Yes, my name is Troy Hadley. My family has been farming in the Silverton Hills for over 140 years. I'm the fifth generation to be farming this ground, which is marginal ground up in the Cascade foothills. We don't have irrigation. We don't have a lot of the options. And I look around this room, and I call a lot of these guys friends. They're all within the purple zoned area on that the ODA has developed. So there will not be any canola in that area. I believe we need this crop because we don't have any options. Fine fescue is the only option we have. We do rotate with oats. It's just to basically pay bills. Canola is actually, I believe, is more environmental crop to grow because it takes less nitrogen to grow. It allows for more no-till situations on our steep terrain because our flattest field has got a 3% slope on it. Steep is 47 degrees. Again, I'm trying to stay on the time frame, but some of the topics, talking about some of the other rotation, we can't grow clover. We cannot grow economically alfalfa. We've tried. I've had neighbors try. We do grow meadow foam, but the acreage is limited. I've not filled an entire field with meadow foam, most of the time 10 acres. A lot of these specialty crops are high value for 5 acres. What do I do with the other 50 acres in the field or the other 100 acres on the farm? We need to have an option that we don't have to contract with a seed company to grow a commodity. We need to have the option to say, no, well, you're not going to give me a contract for my grass seed. or I'm just going to grow canola. And agronomically, you're not going to be able to overproduce this stuff because you, by the rules and by agronomic sense, you aren't going to continually grow the crop. Numbers that I have ran on our farm, for every acre, it's going to increase the value of my ground by $300 on my farm, and I believe that would translate into other acres across the valley that's grass-seed. Again, the non-irrigated crops, non-irrigated ground, we don't have the vegetable options that a lot of these guys in the central part of the valley have. And the price of canola right now, if you get quoted, is 31 cents. And the research my in-laws, my wife and her dad did, some of the research trials with OSU, the low end was 3,000 pounds, the high end was 4,000 pounds. And more of these naturally produced hybrids are going to yield more that are non-GMO. And if you look, most experts with the crop and look at world market, high protein crops, the value of the canola is only going to skyrocket. It's not going to come back down anytime soon. It's what most experts agree on. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Hello.
Good evening.
Chairman, and others, I'm a farmer from Sublimity, Oregon, and I was one of the ones that grew canola back.
Would you tell us, sir, your name, please?
Oh, Charles Sherman.
Charles, yeah. Welcome.
Chuck, actually. But anyway.
Good evening.
Hi there. I was one of the ones that grew canola, you know, under the experimental 20 acres we had back in, I believe, 2007 mm-hmm. or 2008. And I can tell you there's a lot more value to growing canola than just this 30 cents we're talking about, because you can just see the difference in the crop that follows it. There's a lot of agronomic benefit to growing canola for us. You've got, if you grow wheat as a rotation, wheat is a grass. So you've got the same pest, you've got the same weed problems, and you can't spray them out, you can't work with it. Canola is not the big invasive animal it's been portrayed as. It's a lot different than radish. It has hardly any hard seeds, which means it lasts in the seed bed in the ground will last for years on this radish that doesn't seem to bother any, you know, the specialty seed group. Doesn't seem to bother them near as much. There's way over 2,500 acres of that grown in this valley right now without being, you know, concerned about. So I just, you know, I feel it's a viable thing for me. And I heard earlier this morning, you know, is this bill going to hurt Oregon State? And I'm thinking, is it going to hurt me as a farm and my neighbors that we are, you know, we've already been eliminated field burning, which is a big tool we lost. I've been told I can't even apply for water rights. I have water 100 feet underneath me, but I can't have it. I'm east of Cascade Highway. So I feel this is a viable rotation crop for us. That's what they told us to look for, is a viable rotation crop. And, you know, I don't feel Metaform is one. You know, that's been played with quite a bit. I don't feel it's one. Clover, we grow some clover. It's got a lot more slug problems, a lot more problems than this brassica does for us. I can tell you that because we had it this year, and slugs are just eating us up. So with that, I would just urge you to vote no on this bill.
Thank you very much, Chuck. Appreciate that.
Good evening. My name is Joseph Sherman, and I'd like to echo basically what my dad just said. I farm with him. We have a family farm. Along with, we have a seed cleaning plant, and one of the main benefits I see with canola, we don't have to clean it, which most grassy crops requires, you know, between 5 and 10 cents of a cost per pound to clean. So you eliminate that whole thing right off the bat with canola. You just take it, and it's crushed, and it's processed. And for us, it benefits us, and our whole farm system is, it's easier, more efficient. And when I was at Oregon State, basically, I always was drilled. You have to be sustainable as a farmer to get to the future and keep it going and keep being efficient. And that's what canola will allow us to do. Because right now we have pests, and all we have is simply spray it or put bait out. And the way the world's going, they don't want us to do that. It's more pressure every day to take our chemicals away, our tools that way, and field burning's been taken away from us. And so if I can do it with a crop, it's a lot more green. Plus, what canola allows us to do is be green with, you know, the end product is a biofuel. And that's, to me, doing that locally seems a lot more sensible than bringing it in from the Midwest, because that's what they're doing right now. You know, the big crushing plant in Rickrell, that's all they're doing. Well, why can't we do that locally? Seems like it makes a lot more sense. A lot less footprint. And I just see a lot of benefits with canola in the valley. A local industry would be, you know, kind of born that way, born out of that. And as a farmer, I don't want to see any of these vegetables see guys go out of business. I want to coexist with them. I'm not looking to push them out. You know, I want to be up in my area where there is no production. The last 30 years, there hasn't been any irrigated vegetable seed crop. And I don't see them coming in asking us to plant for them. So if they're not going to come ask me to plant for them, why would I want to screw up their crop? I mean, it's without irrigation, they can't come up here anyway, where I'm at. And we're totally isolated. So the science isn't there for them to argue that it's going to be cross-pollinated or, you know, causing them any problems like that way. And I just urge you to, you know, not set this precedent of banning a crop for production, because where's it going to lead? I mean, who's next that's going to come up to your committee and say, I want grass seed banned because it messes up my grapes or my vineyard? That's next. I don't see how it won't be. So with that, I urge you not to go with this.
Thank you very much. Questions for the Shermans or Mr. Headley? Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
Is there a subsidy on canola?
You
mentioned it this morning.
Not aware of anymore.
2 years ago, there was something, but I know there's someone in this room that can answer that, and I can't, okay?
The tax credit that Oregon had for biofuels, there was that, if it's still in effect, I don't believe it is, but if it is, it's not really a factor with the word of canola will be produced because of will be marketed because it's more valuable as a food crop. So then that won't help.
Thank you.
Representative Clem.
Thank you. Troy, do you know if your in-laws are going to testify later?
There might be some...
I don't see him here. So.
Yeah, my wife is out of town. She's on her way.
Let me ask you then. Between the... are you gentlemen in the purple zone in this proposed map or no?
No.
Outside of it. Okay. So... this is more about your in-law's place and having married into one.
I can try.
You may not be able to do that. One thing I'm curious about is during the period of the research trials that I think are in the middle of the purple zone. So there has been canola grown recently on a maybe few hundred acre total basis in the purple area. And I'm wondering if, and I don't know the answer to this question, which is always dangerous, I wonder if there's any experience from neighbors about the research fields and what happened there.
Chairman Witt, Representative Clem, I believe the current rule that was just filed last month, I'm not going to say for sure, I don't believe any of the fields were in that zone because, I mean, they were right around most of the field, or several of the fields were right there and were outside the boundaries now. Of course, obviously, it was in the outside box, which is the whole valley. Anyhow, so yeah, that was grown. And I can't speak for what other people feel. I know when we did grow it, the specialty seeds did plant crops within 3 miles of the fields. You could see that just going down the road a ways. And the same people that are arguing about that, they don't say anything to the state highway that's propagating the wild mustard. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think, you know, for most of us, we're trying to figure out if it's really going to, at what point do you hurt the neighbor?
That's well, the general principle. I mean,
and we have a little bit of experience, not a lot, but we have a little bit where we are.
I welcome all of you to come out to the farm, to the fields. you will not find a canola plant. And I looked in, just looking at labels, plan for all the chemicals we put on our grass seed fields already. I just looked at a wheat chemical that everybody's using now to control Poa annua, which is annual bluegrass. The first thing on the list that kills is volunteer canola. So this stuff is extremely easy to kill. Talk to a grower that's growing canola, has no trouble with a third of a pint of MCPA, which is a broadleaf herbicide. Most of clover guys, I've been told, because we don't grow clover, obviously I said we can't grow it. I don't have experience with it, but I've been told they regularly put at least one shot at 3 pints per acre to control the wild mustard in the fields. So they can control the canola in the clover without trouble.
Additional questions or comments? Gentlemen, very much appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much. You did a great job. Folks, I'm going to ask that we stand at ease here for a moment. We're having a little difficulty getting our telephone system worked out.
Peppard, Leah Rogers, and Justin Davis.
Do we have one more?
Four. Skip Graham.
Is it Skip Graham? Somebody call him in, please. Okay, please proceed. Welcome to our committee.
I'm Leah, so I don't know if I'm going second or...
I'm Justin Davis. I think I'm calling.
You may decide among yourselves and proceed.
Okay. Well, and actually, I was going to read testimony on behalf of Clint Lindsay, who was not able to come back today. It's very short.
Okay.
So for the record, my name is Leah Rogers. I'm field director of Friends of Family Farmers, and this is a testimony of Clint Lindsay on House Bill 2427. In 2005, and I'm just going to read it verbatim. I'm not going to change pronouns.
Okay.
In 2005, our family farm, A2R, applied for an exemption permit to grow canola in the Willamette Valley near Corvallis. We wanted to crush the seed on farm for our own biofuel production. Although we met or exceeded all the requirements for the permit, the ODA denied our request on the grounds that allowing any commercial cultivation of canola was simply too big a risk to a multi-million dollar specialty seed industry. The ODA/OSU oilseed study was uncommissioned, and our farm participated as a test farm. We began hearing from neighboring farmers, local seed companies, and others who all expressed alarm about commercial-scale cultivation of canola and asked us to rethink our decision. We were putting other growers at risk of contamination and loss of income. We were possibly allowing a genetically altered plant into an environment where it would get out, spread, and contaminate other growers and be very difficult to eradicate. We regret our decision to push for commercial-scale cultivation of canola in the Willamette Valley. We recognize then that there are alternative oilseed crops such as flax and camelina that are viable alternatives to canola. These alternatives do not harm other growers. Many other areas of the world depend on pure Willamette Valley seed for their needs. Why would we risk the health of a large, healthy, and critical food industry that brings tens of millions of dollars to Oregon each year to serve the needs of a small group, particularly when canola can be grown in many other parts of Oregon without threatening other seed industries? We ask that the committee restore the protection of the specialty seed industry and restrict canola cultivation in the Willamette Valley. The risks are too great and the potential benefits too small. Clint Lindsay.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
My name is Skip Gray, and I farm in the middle of the protected zone. So you would think that I wouldn't care too much, but I've served in the trenches with fighting this canola thing because I've heard too many of my customers come to my fields and say, if we see this crop grown in our valley, we're going to lose this, and do not lose this opportunity because it's easier to prevent a mess than it is to clean one up. And whether that's real or imagined, I don't know, but it's real in their minds. And so it's a high margin crop for us, which is why you don't hear a lot about it, because we don't want to tell anybody else about that. But it's obviously a very important part of our farming operations. If you look at the marginal areas in that map, you'll see where brassica species have been grown in the past, and if you draw a 1 to 3 mile radius around those, you'll see why I'm here to support my friends that are on that periphery. And that's extremely important. And I'd close just saying that I have much to lose. I'm not going to argue with somebody that thinks they don't have any other alternatives. I maintain that there are a lot of alternatives out there, and they have not as much to lose as I have to lose if we lose our specialty seed industry. Thanks.
Thank you very, very much. Good evening.
Good evening. My name is Justin Davis. I'm with Cicada Seed America. We're a vegetable and flower seed company based out of Yokohama, Japan. We're the third largest brassica seed company. Actually, we're the number one brassica seed company in the world regarding broccoli, hybrid cabbages, cauliflowers, etc. We do a lot of production in the Willamette Valley. We have productions for the seed produced in the Willamette Valley that we produce for our company is sold in every country in the world. And we come to the Willamette Valley for many attributes, including the long day lengths, the temperate weather, and quite frankly, the lack of canola in the area, the lack of other brassica weeds that host many diseases that other people have brought up, Xanthomonas leaf spot, Xanthomonas campestris, which is called blackleg, anyways, lots of diseases, a lot of pests that these other brassica weeds and also canola harbor are reasons why we come to the Willamette Valley, because they don't, because there's not a lot of it here, and we can get quality, and that high quality is what drives the price for our seeds up, and continues our basis and able for us to come here and support the growers in the valley. So I support this bill and hope that that we can continue to keep this canola-free area.
Thank you very much. And not only appreciate your comments, but folks are doing a great job keeping it within the time limits. It's greatly appreciated. Any questions for this panel? Folks, thank you very, very much. Okay, next I'd like to call up, please, Michael Vandehey, Thomas Endicott by phone, and Matt Crawford. Folks here?
I'm here on the phone. Can you hear me there in Salem?
Yes, go ahead. Mr. Endicott, would you like to begin your testimony?
I would be happy to begin. I had supplied a couple of PowerPoint slides to the committee staff this morning, and I think they should be on the computer there. Matt could drive a couple slides.
Yep. Okay, and Mr. Endicott, can you do your presentation in 3 minutes, sir?
I will do my very best.
All right, thank you very much.
The slides are also included in a packet for the committee. I supplied 15 copies of that to the committee staff this morning, so those should be distributed to committee members now, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yes, they are.
Okay, very good. So for the record, my name is Thomas Endicott. I'm the Vice President of Business Development for Willamette Biomass Processors. We're an oil seed crush facility in Riprail, Oregon, crushing 120 tons of oil seed per day. We process canola, camelina, soybeans, and flax. We separate that seed into oil and meal. We sell the oil to the biofuel market, to the livestock feed market, or to the food grade market, and we sell the meal to dairies and chicken producers. I'm also a board member of the Willamette Valley Oil Seed Producers Association, and I've been a member of the Canola Advisory Committee through Oregon Department of Agriculture since 2005. So it's been an enjoyable 7 years of dealing with this issue. I'd like to encourage the committee to take no action on this bill. Director Kovin did a great job of explaining the administrative rule. It was the result of 18 months of discussion with every group you could imagine being involved, including many of the people in the room there today with the specialty seed industry, Clover Commission, Wheat League, Metafoam, you name it, they were involved. And I think it's very frustrating for me to see this bill come before the legislature, not because the admin rule is unfair or unreasonable, but because certain groups are simply unhappy with the outcome of that collaborative process. On the slides, I just want to make the point on that first slide with the map, I assume you're looking at that there will be no canola inside that exclusion zone, and so we're only talking about canola on the edges of the valley. We're only talking about 2,500 acres, and we're talking about dry land, non-irrigated ground for grass and grain rotation. That 2,500 acres, you may hear the companies saying, is this worth the risk? This is not a lot of material. This is 10 million pounds of seed. This means the world to the growers, the landowners, the farm managers who own those pieces of ground that you've heard from and need this rotation. It also would supply about 10 million pounds of seed to our facility, provided we're the buyers. That's about 10% of our capacity, and that's meaningful to us. as well. Matt, you if you want to go through those pictures real quick, just cycle through those. We'll see a few pictures.
Thomas, can you begin to close on your presentation?
Matt will need to cycle through the pictures just to show you, and then there's a chart, and I will close.
Okay, thank you very much.
I think the camera online is showing, so what you're seeing there is Brassica rapa rapeseed, Brassica rapa turnip, Raffinia sativa radish. Then you're seeing those in bloom. These crops are extremely similar. You heard Carol Mallory-Smith talk about this earlier this morning. That's in bloom. And then I want to show you this one chart. This chart's included in your packet. Matt, one more slide.
It's there, Thomas. It's up.
Okay, it'll draw down the names and then the chart. Okay, here we go. So this is what is confusing to me and has been for over 18 months now. We have turnip in the valley. It is genetically identical to rapeseed. There are at least 4,000 acres. We can't tell exactly how many acres because the specialty seed industry will never release that information. They claim it's proprietary. I guess it is. Radish, I estimate 10,000 acres last year, and I think it could be as high as 20,000 acres this year. Same pests, same diseases, much more problems with weediness on those crops. However, the issue here is on 25 acres in canola. I think the main issue is that canola is a commodity crop. It's not contracted. And really this issue, this bill, is not about the science of 2,500 acres isolated on the edges of the valley. It's really about competition for acres. And it's frustrating that these specialty seed companies want to bring a bill that...
Thomas, can you please put a wrap on it?
This is the end of my testimony.
Thank you.
This is public policy to maintain a monopoly on their rotation crops. Turnip and radish are the same, and I would like to encourage the committee to take no action on this bill, leave it right here on the floor of this committee, and let ODA do the job.
Thank you, sir.
Since 1989.
Thank you very much. All right. Questions for Mr. Endicott. Representative Whitsitt.
Do you receive a subsidy from the state or federal government to process canola for biofuels, and how much?
There is an Oregon tax credit of 5 cents per pound if the oil seed goes to biodiesel production. At this point, oil seed grown in Oregon does not go to biodiesel production. The biodiesel plant processes 100% used cooking oil, and the virgin oil is too expensive for them. The price would be the same to the grower regardless, but this seed and the oil from the seed will go to food-grade markets because that is the highest value for the seed.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Mr. Endicott, are the processors processing canola seed presently?
Mike Vandehei was hoping to present testimony this morning. He was unable to be there tonight. He submitted testimony to the committee by email. Mike has grown 700 acres of canola in Banks, Oregon, legally outside the current protected zone for the last 3 years, 700 acres over 3 years. We've purchased that seed, and we have processed it, and we have moved it on to the appropriate markets.
Can you tell me approximately how many pounds of seed those 700 acres represent?
I believe that last year on 300 acres, we received about 800,000 pounds of seed.
800,000.
To give you an idea, 2,500 acres of seed would produce about 10 million pounds of seed.
And that 10 million pounds, what percentage of your supply, of your seed source, would that represent?
For our plant, that would represent about 10% of our total capacity.
About 10%. Without revealing any privileged information, can you give us geographic areas where you would receive the bulk of your seed presently?
We are a facility that is both conventional and organic crops.
Uh-huh.
We process organic soybeans primarily for one particular customer. Those soybeans arrive at our facility from wherever they ship them to us from. We don't necessarily know. We process them for that company, and we ship out the oil and the meal.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any further questions for Mr. Endicott? Thank you very much, sir. You're welcome to stay with us if you so choose, or you're dismissed. Your choice.
Thank you for the opportunity to participate by phone. I really appreciate it.
Well, and we recognize that it's not an easy task to do this by phone. I think you've done an excellent job, and thank you very much for your understanding.
Thank you.
Please.
Thank you, Chairman Witt and the committee. My name is Matt Crawford, and I am a farmer in Perrydale. We farm 1,000 acres. Yeah. I'm also president of the Willamette Valley Oilseed Producers Association, and I was a member of the Oregon Department of Agricultural Advisory Committee that came up with one of the earlier rules on canola. I think one of the main difficulties with this subject is the fact that every pro and con you hear about this subject, there is truth in it. There's nobody here that is just outright coming up and trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes. Everybody truly believes in their heart that this is in their best interest and in the best interest of the people they represent or care for. And so the Department of Ag, that being so, one side wants one thing, one side wants another. The Department of Ag is all we have left to try to be in the middle and figure out the right way to go. And nobody is 100% happy with what they came up with, and most are not happy at all, but it was a compromise. And true compromise means people are not happy on both sides of the subject. And while it is not perfect, they did spend months, even a year, trying to come up with something that would allow the two sides to be able to come to some agreement and to see if canola was a viable option and could be an industry in Willamette Valley. And they have done that. Many people are upset, but that's what they have done. And so I guess since we only have 3 minutes, I'd like to say that this is, that canola would be a very viable and helpful agronomic and economic rotation crop. We do not have other options. If we did, none of us would be here. I've spent thousands of hours, almost a farmer, trying to get the opportunity to grow canola to be a viable rotation crop. If there was other options, they would be there. Farmers don't just grow what they grow because they like to or they think it's the right thing to do. It's because either agronomically and economically it makes sense so that they can keep their business going. And that's what canola allows us to do, is it allows us to have an option where right now when you're talking about dry land farms, we don't have irrigation. We only have two economic viable crops, that's grass seed and wheat. And we need some sort of break. We grow peas, we grow red clover, all these work occasionally, but generally they're break-even crops, and it would be very, very helpful if we could have an economic viable option as well.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Crawford? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony. I'd like to call forward, please, Scott Miller and Greg Riches. And Janet Steele, please. Good evening. Please
Good evening.
Determine your order and proceed.
Chairman Witt and panel, my name is Scott Miller. I farm grass seed, vegetable seed, and berries near Woodburn, Oregon. I am a fourth generation farmer in the valley and a second generation vegetable seed grower. I have a son who wishes to follow me in growing vegetable seeds. The reason canola production in the Willamette Valley has a potential to destroy the seed business for me is as followed. Canola cross-pollinates with mustard, hybrid radish, and cabbage. Canola is a contaminant in clover, grass seed, and in vegetable seed. It cannot always be cleaned out of a seed lot. If it is discovered in a seed lot, that seed lot becomes worthless. The expanded presence of canola in the Willamette Valley will diminish and possibly kill a $40 million vegetable seed business in Oregon, which I and my son are a part of. A business that has been established and exists without government subsidies. Much of Oregon vegetable seeds are exported around the world. Many foreign countries perceive canola growing in a vegetable seed production area as a source of contamination and will refuse seed produced in where canola is present. Oregon's reputation for high quality seed comes into question as canola is permitted to reproduce around the valley. Jobs and income will be diminished if canola is allowed to grow inside the current Willamette Valley canola protected growing district. ODA has supported a growing district for high-valued seeds in the past, but under political pressure from the governor's office, ODA has weakened its stand on protecting this growing district. That has in the past allowed the vegetable seed industry to grow and to prosper in Oregon. The introduction of canola in the valley would displace all seed growers entities that have been here for 3 and 4 generations. Oregon seed growers have a good reputation in the seed world today. Please help us maintain the standard of excellence Oregon has in the world in the seed business today. Stand with growers of specialty seeds and grass seed and clover growers and support House Bill 2427, which would prohibit commercial seed production of canola in the protected districts of the Willamette Valley. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
I guess I'll jump in here. I'll make this short. I didn't know I was going to be speaking tonight, so okay. I'll be your easy one.
All right.
I was born and raised on a fifth generation.
Would you introduce yourself?
Oh, excuse me. I'm Greg Riches. I'm with Lakeside Ag Ventures. We're a vegetable seed and grass seed company in the Albany area.
Welcome, Greg.
Thank you very much. So I was born and raised on a fifth generation, or we are fifth generation, grass seed farm in the Silverton Hills. And like some other people have earlier spoke, I understand, I hate being up here having to talk about this right now, and I know we all do, because it's a very divisive issue, and it's pitting farmers against farmers, and nobody wants that.
Right.
But I will say that coming from the grass seed industry, even though I do work for a vegetable seed company now, I've heard a lot of talk about canola being a rotation for grass seed crops. And the one, I guess, little bit of testimony I'd like to add that I haven't heard is that, having been in the grass seed industry for 15 years on the business side of things, where we've sold and marketed seed into Europe, talked to multiple customers that have said that the worries they have now, or the doors we're opening, is that they will now be testing the grass seed that gets shipped into Europe for canola. It's another weed that we're going to have to deal with in the grass seed crops that has now opened the door to increased costs with grass seed companies because of the worry Europe has to introduce canola into grass seed lots into Europe. So that is an issue I haven't heard discussed yet. So other than that, appreciate the time and thank you.
Certainly appreciate you being here this evening. Thank you. Good evening.
Chair Witt and honored representatives, I'm Janet Steele. I'm president of the Albany Area Chamber of Commerce. We represent about 600 businesses, many of them agricultural businesses. And we've long been opposed to moving canola into the valley. And most recently, our Governmental Affairs Committee voted unanimously, 26 very different businesses voted unanimously to once again support Senate Bill 2427 to ban canola. And I'd like to read you my testimony. On behalf of the Albany Area Chamber of Commerce, I am here today to lend our support to House Bill 2427 to ban canola from being grown in the Willamette Valley. As you all know, the Willamette Valley is one of the top vegetable seed producing regions in the world, with sales of locally grown seeds bringing in over $30 million each year. And today I've heard $50 million. Those dollars go to family farmers, seed businesses, and ultimately to the thousands of small businesses in the valley that support them with products and services. If you add in the impacts to organic growers, clover seed producers, and fresh market vegetable producers, you increase the financial impact to over $100 million in sales in the valley. These family farms and their supporting businesses have depended on the Willamette Valley being an established and protected seed district where canola has been limited for years. To think that the ODA would be willing to take away the unique vegetable seed industry we have in the valley and allow canola to be grown here has stunned our area farmers and local businesses and put our area farms and the seed crops we all depend on in grave danger. We know that canola is grown in other parts of Oregon for oil and biofuel, and there is no objection of it staying where it's currently allowed. But to allow canola to enter the Willamette Valley and devastate a healthy and vibrant vegetable seed economy is unconscionable. As ODA Director Katie Koba told the Senate committee on February 14th, it's fair to say in other parts of the world, specialty seed industries have been destroyed by large amounts of canola, and that there is a level of canola where you do jeopardize specialty seeds, but we just don't know what that acreage is. If that is the case, then why is the ODA gambling with the future of the Willamette Valley and our food supply? We need to save and protect the Willamette Valley's world-renowned vegetable and seed-producing region. Please keep the Willamette Valley safe and vote to support HB 2427.
Thank you so very much, all three of you. Do we have questions for this panel? Mr. Miller, I try not to focus in on any one comment that anyone makes, because oftentimes when we speak, we make statements that are subject to questioning. So I'm not trying to put you on the spot, and I apologize in advance if I do. But you made a comment that I feel I have an obligation to pursue further. And you mentioned something about pressure from the governor's office changing the ag department's the manner in which the ag department, for lack of a better term, manages canola. Do you have any evidence of that?
I don't believe I said that, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
You definitely did, because we were talking about it. Like, I wonder what he knows. So I was curious, but I didn't want to ask.
Okay.
So
one comment I would add to that might mitigate, and I don't know what you were referring to, the governor's energy plan does have a strong emphasis on biofuels, mm-hmm. and the goal of making us a fossil fuel free zone, foreign fossil fuel free zone, in X number of years.
It is heavily into
biofuels or alternate fuels as a major goal, and I don't know what you were referring to, but
I see.
I could interpret that comment as a possibility.
I think I could as well.
I didn't hear it as a negative comment. Just
all right. I didn't either. I was just looking for information, and I think Representative Thompson, that suggests where that may have come from. Are there additional questions or comments?
I don't think that's true.
Panel members, thank you so very, very much. Appreciate that.
Oh, I don't
know about that.
Okay. I'd like to call forward, please, Barry Bashu, Blake Rowe, and Scott Setniker, please.
Where's the biodiesel? I don't.
Good evening to the three of you. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm the new and improved version of Blake Rowe. I am Jana Jarvis, representing the Oregon Wheat Growers League, and I hope you don't tell him I said that. In any event, we are here today to oppose House Bill 2427, and for one very primary reason. We're very concerned about the precedent that you would be considering here today. Just briefly, in a discussion about canola, and I apologize to you, I was unable to be sit in the hearing this morning, so I don't know how much background you have on canola, but canola is used for a lot of different things outside of biofuels. It's used for lubricants, newspaper inks, candles, lipsticks. It's also a key ingredient in lots of food. So the demand for canola has been growing steadily, and that's one of the reasons that it's become a more attractive crop to grow. It's also, from a wheat grower's perspective, a very important rotation crop, even for wheat growers here in the valley. It's a broadleaf, deep-rooted crop. It provides a significant benefit as a rotation crop, helps to break down disease and pest cycles. And so as no-till farming practices evolve, the benefits of crop rotation with canola are significantly more important. But the biggest issue in all of this is what House Bill 2427 would do would allow the state to pick winners and losers. It, you know, the markets typically define what crops are grown, and coexistence is something that farmers have done since agriculture has begun. So our concern is that markets can change more quickly than the legislative process, and as we don't want to do damage to Oregon's agricultural industry by having the legislature define what crops can and can't be grown in this state. And so for that reason, we would ask you to oppose House Bill 2427. I thank you.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
My name is Scott Setnicker. I'm opposed to the bill. First off, I'm a farmer, family farm in Independence, Oregon, just across the river. I'm a graduate of Oregon State University. I graduated in 2004 with a crop science degree and a ag business management minor. A third generation farm, a farm with my dad, and my grandpa started the farm back in the 50s. And I got a 4-year-old son that hoping someday he's going to continue on the legacy. On our farm, we have a real diversified farm rotation. We grow about a third of our crop, our farmland is in grass seed production, a third of our ground is in peppermint production, and about a third of our ground is in vegetable production, which would be sweet corn and green beans. And we also have hazelnuts as well. So we have, our approach on our farm has always been to stay as diversified as we can and weather the markets that way. I served on the work group with the ODA in 2009, and at that point we came up with no consensus, and the rule kind of, the canola ban stayed in place at that time. Currently, the new rule, about one third of our farmland is in the boundary where canola will be allowed. And another thing, on our farm, back in like 2007, we actually worked, when the biofuels thing started to take off, we invested in an oilseed crusher, a small on-farm facility where we could crush. You know, we were envisioning crushing like 100 acres of canola a year and making biodiesel and blending it with our fuel. But since then, we haven't been able to grow canola, so we basically just mothballed the project, and the facility is up and running. It just hasn't been able to run since we haven't been able to grow canola. And in 2008, I raised a 70-acre field of canola through the Oregon State program when we were allowed to grow it through the research. I think that year I had $960 per acre gross return on that, and coincidentally, that was the same year that the grass seed market went down, and I grossed more dollars per acre on the canola than I did on any of my grass seed acres. In 2009, I wanted to grow canola, but we weren't allowed to, so I grew camelina, which is, at the time, we thought might have been a viable option. I actually planted like 200 acres of camelina, and it yielded basically half of what the canola yielded, plus the value of the seed wasn't near as good because it doesn't have it hasn't been around for near as long, so the value of the feed was really hard. The oil isn't edible, so that devalued it some, and the meal that after the crushed seed isn't, at the time we couldn't feed it to near as many different types of livestock. I would agree with the unprecedented nature of this bill. There's other crops that have marketing orders to control, like spearmint, the production, but you're still allowed to grow the crop. You're just not allowed to sell the oil. So I guess that's all I got.
All right, Scott. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Barry, good evening. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Barry Bashu. I farm near Gresham, Oregon, raise a lot of crops, including vegetables, berries, pumpkins, nursery stock, unfortunately. I'm here to clarify a couple of things. First of all, Oregon Farm Bureau's position, there's a lot of misinterpretation of our policy positions on a number of bills. On this one in particular, our policy is particularly clear and has been in place since 2005. Our policy supports the Department of Agriculture regulating oilseed production and opposes an outright ban on canola. This is a group decision. It's a grower decision. It's not a leadership position. Incidentally, Marion County Farm Bureau recently asked us to oppose this bill as well, which is our largest county farm bureau, as our production committee made up of growers, including some seed producers, have asked us also to oppose this legislation. There are a plethora of bills asking the legislature to make determinations regarding what crops should or should not be grown in Oregon. On a broad philosophical level, I would ask you to consider the ramifications of legislature making decisions as to who can and cannot grow a crop and whether or not that is good public policy. Should the legislature determine which crops are in and which ones are out? Additionally, some bills are asking legislators to make determination as to which production practices and types of farms are preferable. Entwined in all of these discussions are suggestions that this body should also determine which markets are more important than others. I can't imagine farming in a state where the legislature determines which markets are and are not acceptable. Imagine yourself trying to vote on bills that make one product's market more important than another. What happens when a more valuable crop comes along? Do we then renege on our original commitment to a previously protected segment of an industry? Farm Bureau believes that farming decisions are best made on the farm. The most important market to a farmer is their own. Their income is a result of the choices that they make with the land and the resources that they have. I have seen a rise and demise of the nursery market on my own farm. To determine that one farmer's income is more important than another's only divides our industry further. I think it is unfortunate that you are being put in a position to split the baby. There is a place for the consideration of whether or not individual decisions have an impact on neighboring farms. That place is the Department of Agriculture. They are the state's agency with the resources and expertise to be able to resolve these issues. As to HB 2427, the Department of Agriculture has managed canola control districts for a number of years to address concerns over disease and plant pest issues. As part of this management program, the department was obligated to review its rules and file its new proposals. Farm Bureau supported the role of the department to develop its initial rules, including the control districts, and supports its ability to promulgate its current ones. It is disheartening to have to engage in a battle between farmers. There are no winners. Many of these people in this room are personal friends. I hope they are still when this is all over. I had hoped that the industry would find a way to deal with this issue on its own without engaging the legislature. The Department of Agriculture remains the best hope for that. I recognize your right to engage in legislation. I appreciate that, but I urge you to carefully consider the actions you are being asked to take. I urge you to oppose this legislation and let ODA continue to do its work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for this panel? Representative Whitson.
I was wondering if there are crops like peanuts that are controlled by the federal government and the government decides when crops are grown and when they aren't grown and when fields are left fallow. Could you discuss some of those crops?
Well, peanuts, to my knowledge, peanuts are more controlled by the contractual arrangements they have with people to buy them than they are in terms of whether they're grown or not. But I'm certainly no expert on peanuts.
Hops?
Like I was talking about spearmint, for example, it has a marketing order.
Yeah.
So there's only so many pounds that are allowed to be sold, and that is controlled. I don't know the details of it. I'm a new grower to the organization, but it's controlled. The Pacific Northwest states, there's a group of them, and the ODA, I think, of the different states are involved. But the pool of the amount that's allowed to be sold is basically what controls it. You can plant the crop. I could plant, you know, as much as I want, and if I have the oil, I just can't sell it into the marketplace. And so that's, I know one way that they're, Meadow Foam is the same way here locally in the Valley. It has a marketing order on it as well. So,
thank you.
I'm unaware of, Chair Witt, Representative Whitson, I'm unaware of any controls that do it based on market. There are obviously the control district, the current control district with canola, and the proposed control district with canola are based on concerns of pest disease, etc. But I'm unaware of any market driven demands that say you can't grow a crop. You can grow it, but you may not be able to get as much money for it, or you may not be able to get a contract for it.
Representative Klim.
Hi there. I wanted to try with you again the question I asked the gentleman earlier. Since you had a trial plot recently, do you know, or maybe we'll hear from one of your neighbors in a minute, but do you know if there were any known problems?
No one has ever came to me and said anything. I don't think there has been. We've continued to farm corn in the field the last 3 years after the canola, and it's been no issues. If we've had an issue, no one's came and said anything to me. And my field, for the record, was outside of the protected
purple
inside zone. I was well outside of the boundary, so we were on the fringe of the valley.
Additional questions or comments? Thank you all very, very much. Appreciate your testimony. Next, I'm going to call up as a panel, please, Dave Wattiger. And if I'm butchering that, I apologize. Frank Morton and Sarah Klieger, please.
Sarah,
go ahead.
Couldn't make it tonight.
Sarah couldn't make it. Could we have Nick Tishinen, please? And who else are we missing?
I think I left over there.
Is how about Clint Lindsay? You read his testimony. Okay. This is getting easier all the time. And Ivan Molesky? All right. Wonderful. We finally got a winner.
Far better looking than I am.
Welcome okay. to the three of you, and please proceed.
All right, Chairman Witt, members of the committee. My name is Nick Tishinen. I'm the owner of Universal Seed Company. It's a vegetable seed production company in Independence, Oregon, established in 1989. I'm also a farmer. I farm hazelnuts and vegetable seed and grass seed. I'm a Farm Bureau member. I have a degree in agronomy, and I've spent 35 years in the vegetable seed production business worldwide. I have a prepared statement, but I'd like to address a couple of issues. I've been making some notes. First, Brian, to answer your question concerning the trials, there were no problems because before those trials were planted, we worked with ODA to determine the isolations and where those fields would be, and so the vegetable seed production stayed away from that area, and therefore there was no outcrossing. So these trials weren't placed at random. They were very carefully controlled. I have another comment about those trials. I thought that there were actually five trials with 20 acres each. I'm quite surprised to hear there was a 70-acre trial. That wasn't part of the program. Of those five trials of 20 acres each, three of them were partially or completely lost to winter kill. And the data that was collected by OSU to represent the yields misrepresented the data from those trials because they didn't take the entire trial. What they did is they took the harvested acreage and said that that was the yield on the field. So the yield data was actually misrepresented. I just thought I'd point that out. The other thing I'd like to point out is that the current rule with ODA allows for 2,500 acres of production. If you think of that, 2,500 acres of production could be 50 50-acre fields, or it could be 25 100-acre fields, or it could be 100 25-acre fields. So we're actually talking about quite a number of fields and quite a bit of acreage. The protected zone, if you look at that map, is protected in that canola is not allowed to be produced within it. However, If you look at the east side in the Silverton Hills, an area where canola will be grown, it's going to be driven straight through the protected zone to Rickreel to be crushed. And as we all know, and I can state as a farmer, farm trucks leak, things escape. So the protected zone, as of the time the first canola crop is produced, will no longer be protected. There will be volunteers. It's a matter of fact, and so it's going to have to be controlled somehow. And ODA's suggestion is that it be, you know, controlled on a cost basis for cleanup, for mitigation. And mitigation is our concern. The other thing I wanted to point out is that the chart that Thomas Endicott put up here, showing the comparison of the radishes and all that you have in your packet, I take issue with several of the claims that are made there, and I would simply point out that unless he has some scientific backup, then his assertions are basically hearsay. On to my testimony, I'll simply paraphrase. Like everyone else has already told you, I came here with a great deal of worldwide experience, started my company 30 years ago because this is an ideal spot. And my company has thrived. The growers who grow for me have thrived. It's been a great thing. Thank you. The fact that one of my customers was here today from Japan to testify about the fact that they're concerned already means that the damage has been done. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick. Who's next?
I'll do that. Because my submitted testimony is too long, I'm going to paraphrase it to keep it
thank
nice
you
and short. My name is Representative or Chairman Witt. My name is Frank Morton.
Welcome.
I live near Philomath, Oregon. I farm in Benton County. I grow about 200 different varieties of specialty seeds. On my farm, we do grow organically, and my farm is actually got is an organic vegetable produce farm. So I get to see this issue from two perspectives, from the seed grower perspective as well as from the organic vegetable grower perspective. So I think that both aspects of our farming operation are endangered by this. The comments by Bob McReynolds earlier about the threat to fresh market vegetables makes that very clear. And I want to say that since I've been a member of the Willamette Valley Specialist Seed Association beginning in 2006, this issue has never gone away. And it's wearing us out. Since 1989, the ODA has protected this valley from canola growing, just as it protects an area in central Oregon, an area in southeastern Oregon, and an area in northeastern Oregon. The area along the southeastern border is there to protect seed growers in Idaho. It's not there for the benefit of Oregon growers. The central Oregon district doesn't even grow vegetable or brassica seed crops, and yet they maintain that there even through the last rule revision. So we do regulate where things are grown in the state. What we would like to do is see the Willamette Valley preserved as a world-class seed growing area. And it's not as if we have another one. So ODA has made contradictory claims regarding the amount of acreage that they foresee for the valley. They keep saying 2,500 acres. However, they also say that the whole reason for this is to provide a rotational crop for grass seed growers. And as questions by Representative Whitsett this morning pointed out, you would need 100,000 acres of canola to do that. So 100,000 acres of canola would destroy the industry, and I think even Director Kobo would agree with that. She has said so. So, yes, thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Nellie McAdams, and I'm a fifth-generation farmer from Gaston, Oregon, as well as the iFarm Program Director for Friends of Family Farmers. Our Executive Director and Policy Director, Ivan Molesky, submitted his, our official testimony, along with letters from seed growers from around the world stating their concerns in light of the destruction of other seed areas in Europe and Australia. And I've also included an information packet with including OSU's most recent study on canolas of 2010. In addition to submitting that testimony, I would like to present testimony as a concerned citizen, including some observations from this morning's meeting, and some of those points overlap with our Friends of Family Farmers testimony. First, I wanted to address the issue of whether or not ODA can regulate based on market-based concerns, and I'd like to point you to ORS 570.405, which is the department's, gives the department the authority to create controlled districts. In that, I will quote, for the general protection of horticultural, agricultural, or forest industries. So that statute uses the word industries twice. In my interpretation, in the common interpretation, industries implies that the whole statute was created to protect based on market-based concerns. In fact, it's ridiculous to think that a control district would be created to protect for a plant just for the plant's own sake and not for the effect that that plant would have on the industry. There has not been a really significant fiscal impact statement attached to the rule. I did not see any information on that. And there's not been any cost-benefit analysis that's been done. But just from a general cost-benefits analysis, looking at specialty seed, canola, and fresh vegetables, all those industries total well over $100 million. The benefit, I guess, of the rule as written would be $1 to $2 million for canola production, which could also come from other crops. So it could be substituted. In addition, this rule change has come around pretty abruptly without any explanation, without any additional research or changes of condition or any real explanation from the Department of Agriculture. It's our opinion that in 2009, a consensus was reached and a compromise was made with that rule. Since then, there have been no additional information shown to change the original parameters of that rule. I would say also that in addition to no research about canola, there's been no research for alternative rotation crops such as flax, such as camelina. OSU received $349,000 from the USDA just this year for additional research on camelina for biofuels. So there is that out there. Also, there are variances within the rule that would allow unlimited amounts of canola to be produced near the boundary, and near is undefined. So 2,500 is not the actual limit. We're very concerned about the possible increase of the acreage cap, and I want to point you also to the Washington State Legislature's rule that banned canola in their specialty seed growing districts. So there is precedent for this, recent precedent.
Thank you very, very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Clem.
Two things. One, can we at some point, maybe not. I was going to ask if we could have the department available. If we ever have another hearing on this topic, can we have the
yes.
department? Because I'm interested in going through some of the points on the rule you just made.
Sure.
Because most of us have a bill, and the rule now has been taken back to my office, so I can't even read it to know what you're saying. So at some point, the department coming back would be good. And then I feel like since Nick used half his time answering my question, which nobody else knew, I feel like I should ask him something just to give him another minute. I don't know what to ask. So how's it going? What's going on? Good to see you.
It's going pretty well. I'm with Frank. You know, we're all getting a little tired of the fight. I appreciate the extra time. I think, you know, taking the opportunity to answer your questions was good enough. The fact is that I recognize this has been very contentious for everyone, but that makes the threat no less real.
And apologize. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll say about the statute, I included that in my testimony that I submitted today, so it should be online, and it's And I also have included the old rule, which there was a comment that the director made today that the rule had to be reviewed. But within the old rule, you can see clearly that the rule did not need to be amended. It needed to be reviewed in the event that no petitions for review were submitted. So this was not an inevitable process.
Thank you. Representative Plum?
Sorry, yeah, I'm glad you said something. It reminded me. You mentioned in the letter attached testimony letters of concern from international seed companies, but I don't have the attachments. So if they're electronic, I'll look there.
Yeah, Representative Plum, I apologize. They were submitted this morning with the testimony of Ivan Molesky.
Okay. I have them in my office. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Very good. Anything further? Panel members, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. I'm going to call up now, please, William Bradley. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you, Chair Witt. Thank you, committee members. My name is William Allen Bradley. I live in Albany. I'm an independent atmospheric scientist. With a degree from Oregon State in 1982. I was a member of a research team for the Department of Botany and Plant Pathology under a USDA grant in 2004-2005 investigating the movement of pollen in genetically modified ryegrass. We didn't complete the study for reasons beyond my control, but as a meteorologist, the transfer of pollen, in this case, is a critical factor. We know about the 3-mile buffers. Think about it. Pollen coming up in a 3-mile-an-hour wind in 1 hour can transfer 3 miles. What we don't know about pollen and these transfers is immense. The state of Oregon has never funded sufficient research to understand the circulation patterns here in the Willamette Valley. Where the pollen is released depends greatly, but it depends on the meteorology. And any given year, we can have a storm that will spread pollen from the south end of the valley to the north end of the valley in 1 hour, in a time when it's viable. We found this in grass, and even though brassica pollen is bigger than grass seed pollen, it's still very light and easily carried by the wind. It's my opinion that there has been insufficient research, although I'm unaware of any research that's been conducted in the last couple years regarding the transfer of pollen. The valley has many different climatic regions, and the movement of pollen depends on a number of meteorological factors that vary every day. That's the summary of what I'm here as an independent, unbiased contributor. I hope that I can enlighten you. If you have any questions, I'd appreciate answering. Thank you, Representative Witt.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Bradley. I appreciate your being here. And I also appreciate the fact that as a scientist, you come with a neutral position, but I think very close, at least, to making a suggestion or recommendation to us that if the other, committee members don't flush out, I intend to. So with that, questions for Mr. Bradley.
Chair Witt, I do have a single sheet of paper that I'd like to submit that talks about critical factors in pollen.
Okay.
And I think it's probably not sufficiently understandable, but perhaps it is. So if I
thank, yes, please.
Thank you.
Mr. Bradley, you said that you're not aware of a study having been conducted on the circulation of pollen.
On the circulation of the atmosphere in the valley.
Thank you. Actually. Okay, thank you. And pollen taking a ride as
correct.
A result.
That's correct.
Do you feel that such a study would benefit us in our decision making?
Chair, absolutely. It would benefit the state of Oregon in many ways, besides this issue of canola seed mm-hmm. It's also genetically modified grass seed, but many, many other pollutants, you name it. We don't know what the future has. There are not very many places that have been well studied. The San Joaquin Valley has been well studied. The Sacramento Valley, less so. Up here in the Willamette Valley, we just haven't got it all together. And with the university system owning the data, it's hard for an independent project like us to have to buy climate data back. When I was an undergraduate at Oregon State, I had my hands on the data. I can't get my hands on the data for less than thousands of dollars now. So it stifles research. We were very stifled in this project.
With your background, would it be your opinion that OSU would be well situated to conduct this kind of study?
Absolutely, sir. With the Atmospheric Sciences Department they have there, it is.
Very good. Anything further? Yes, Representative Krieger.
I'm talking about the lack of information. If it's a public school and public dollars support the school ought to be giving the public the information.
Chair Witt, thank you, Representative.
Perhaps we need a piece of legislation.
That's exactly. You know, my point here is that climate data, the weather data, was paid for by the citizens of the state of Oregon, but it was privatized, as much of the research at Oregon State has been, and that makes it very difficult for independent researchers such as myself, or even when I was employed by a department doing a USDA grant, it was hard to get simple climate data. I wanted to make a little model to model the movement of pollen. It's just not easy to do that. It costs money. It's a mathematical model. Make no mistakes about it. It's a computer type model that's needed.
Would it be reasonable for us to think that the scientists at the Atmospheric Science Department might even be looking for an opportunity to present this kind of information?
I am not in touch with the current faculty or research staff yet. In my past history, some 20, 25 years of dealing with them, I would say absolutely so. I think there's not only personnel capable, but there have been research projects that aim at that. But it's a big subject. You know, things like dry deposition of chemicals from manufacturing is another issue that can help to be resolved with a decent Willamette Valley circulation model.
Thank you very much. Anything else, committee members? Thank you, sir, very, very much.
Thank you, Chair.
I appreciate your commentary here. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Sandra Verlatt, Garth Mulkey, and John Hank Keough. And I'm sorry if I've got your names mispronounced. Good evening.
Feel free.
Welcome.
Hello. My name is Sandra Verlatt. I reside on 119 Meridian Street in Independence, Oregon. I'm opposed of altering the current the prohibition of oilseed canola in the Willamette Valley. I've been in the seed industry for about 18 years and have been involved in multiple roles in various countries, the Netherlands, Australia, and now the United States. In addition, I've traveled to many other geographical areas, for example, South Africa, Thailand, India, to name a few. I've completed various studies, production horticulture, and also completed a master's degree in agribusiness through the University of Melbourne. As per the 1st of October, I joined Universal Seed Company in Independence as general manager. I've been following the canola issue since the start of 2012 and have also been present at multiple hearings to date. The fact that ODA fails to allow canola into the valley is something that should be reconsidered. Both long and short-term consequences should be taken into account, and extensive research has proven the severe issues that one could be dealing with. Key issues, well, they've been named multiple times now. So cross-pollination with the brassicas, more so important that GM canola pollinates specialty seed industry crops. The seed will be worth much less or basically unsaleable into the different markets, for example, Europe, where stringent laws discourage purchasing GM organisms. Increase of pests and diseases that will not only affect brassica crops, proof as to what happened in other production areas is present. In the past, a lot of valuable hybrid red radish production was done in France. Once canola was introduced, it also led to the introduction of the pollen beetles. This insect migrates from canola to other flowering crops like radish. That was the Bois area in France where there's hardly any production left to date. There's pretty much only two areas in the world left to do radish production. That's pretty much the Willamette Valley and New Zealand. The spillage will not only happen, let's say, through the area outside the purple zone, but I feel that it's also going to be through waterways, and it will not only be restricted through the zone that it will be cultivated in, pretty much. Another issue I would like to emphasize is the following. Food security continues to be an ongoing concern and is a subject that can be found on the agenda of various conferences. By 2050, the global population will surpass 9 billion people. And agricultural systems will be increasingly challenged by water scarcity, climate change and volatility. We all also know that the question that continues to come up is, will we be able to produce enough food for all? Think about this question again and try to understand the unique characteristics of the Willamette Valley and its important role in the global specialty seed industry. The agronomy that's associated with growing specialty seed crops shouldn't be underestimated, and it is true that the number of areas where specialty seed crops can be grown is continuously reduced. High-value brassica crops are mainly being grown in the Willamette Valley and, for example, Tasmania, Australia. Research has also proven that land availability is a determined factor for agricultural production. Only a third of the Earth's soil is suitable for agriculture. 30% of this arable soil is expected to experience erosion by 2050 due to unsustainable agricultural practices. The bottom line is that the Willamette Valley should be considered as a unique area in the global specialty seed industry and should treasure its unique characteristics. Growers that would like to use canola as a rotation crop will definitely not be able to compete against the major markets in Canada and Europe, whereas the specialty seed industry will be able to continue to contribute to the long-term future of the Willamette Valley.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Hello. Thank you, Chairman Witt and committee for hearing us this evening. My name is Garth Mulkey. I farm with my lovely wife, Susan, south of Monmouth in Polk County. We have a diversified farming operation. We're primarily grass seed growers. However, we grow clover seed, peas, radishes, vegetable seeds, and some processing vegetables. Vegetable seed production has been very important to our farming operation. In the last 5 years, 10% of our income has come from vegetable seed production. In that time, it has utilized 4% of our farm ground. The profit margin on vegetable seed crops have consistently been 6 to 10 times higher than the commodity crops we grow. In the last 5 years, we've made significant investments into our farm in order to produce vegetable seeds. We have purchased 3 linear irrigation systems, so we can now irrigate 400 acres, where 10 years ago we irrigated 40 acres. We buried 3 miles of underground supply line to feed them that irrigation system, and then we've purchased and installed 2 pumping stations. In 2010, we constructed a 120-acre-foot irrigation reservoir so we could store water, so we could irrigate more of our ground. These projects have employed many people and utilized goods and services from many Oregon businesses. The reason we chose to make these investments was primarily to have more irrigated acres on our farms so we could grow more vegetable seeds. The profits from vegetable seeds have paid a significant amount of the investment we've made. Since 1989, there's been a policy of protecting the Willamette Valley from the threats of canola production. These protections have encouraged the growth of the specialty seed industry, allowing this area to become one of the best areas in the world to produce these high-value crops. The reasons these protections were valuable then are still valuable today. We believe that allowing canola production in the Willamette Valley is a threat to the vegetable seed industry, and therefore a threat to our farm and the livelihood of our employees and ourselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. Comments for this panel?
I'd like to have his water right. It sounds pretty good.
it's stuff we paid for and developed.
Oh, I know. Yeah, a lot of people waiting in line to get one. I'm glad you can use irrigation.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Mulkey, while we have you,
yes.
Apart and aside from the issue of canola, one of the issues that that our committee has been very interested in is economic development, workforce development, and I'm aware, sir, that you are an incredibly good employer, and I sometimes think that farmers don't get enough credit for the contributions they make to our state's economy. Would you take just a moment, please, and tell us a little bit about the wages and benefits that you provide your employees?
Certainly. I have two employees. One of them has been with me for 11 years this month. One of them has been with me for about 16 months. They are salary employees because we have our work, our hours fluctuate. We're 40 hours a week in the winter, and we can be 80 hours a week in the summer. And they understand that, and they like the consistent size of their paychecks. Their salary is about $42,000 a year. We offer full-time or health care benefits for them and their spouses. We're instituting a profit-sharing bonus program because we've done very well working as a team with good quality employees. Without good employees, I don't have a good business. And in order to sustain the type of management it takes to grow high-value crops, I have to have good employees.
Well, sir, I just want to commend you for that partnership that you just told us about, because you, by every appearance, you're a truly great employer. And like so many of our other farming employers across the state, you're making a very significant contribution to our state's economy, and to you and to all the other farming producers. Thank you so much for the great jobs that you do each and every day.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Reardon.
As long as we're digressing, I had the pleasure of being on your farm last summer on a tour, which I enjoyed very much, and you talked a little bit about the extension service and how that helped your growth, your economic development. Could you remind me and maybe the rest of the panel on what I recall as being a very good relationship with the extension service?
Well, it's more than the extension service. It's the university system and the employees of it and the research they've done in the past. In 1980, my father was a founding member of the Oregon Meadow Farm Growers Association, and that was a crop that was developed at OSU and promoted through the extension agents. The no-till farming practices we used, a lot of the incentive to do that came from extension agents and through the NRCS, and there's just been a lot of good programs that we've been able to utilize to educate ourselves, to create opportunities that weren't there before. And I think they've been important programs, and I think they need to continue the support that they've seen in the past.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you very much. And Sandra, I want to thank the seed producers every bit as much. The agricultural producers in this state are the backbone of the economy of so many of our communities. Thank you truly to both of you, and as I say, the rest of the farming community across the state. We appreciate your testimony very much and the jobs you do every day.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to call Hank Keo on the phone, I think. Hank, are you with us?
So rare.
Do we need to call Hank? Hank, call home. okay. I'm next going to call, Matthew Parker and Dean Freeborn.
We've got about three more panels.
more land.
Gentlemen, welcome.
Hi.
Please proceed.
Chair Witt, committee members, my name is Matthew Parker. I'm a farmer in Lebanon, Oregon. I'm a third generation farmer. I farm about 500 acres on my own with the help of my father and my mother. I grow grass seed, wheat, a very tiny small amount of clover, and recently last year I grew 150 acres of flax, and that's kind of what I'd like to talk about today. It's been mentioned several times that flax is a good alternative crop, and I'm here to inform you that that is not the case.
Right.
Flax is an interesting crop. It has a very, very, very limited market. I actually contracted with Willamette Valley Biomass, which had contracts with a few other farmers for about 400 to 600 acres in the valley, and that is the maximum that they can receive and market and still be in the positive side. So the downfall of flax is dealing with the straw. I don't know if any of you are familiar with, but there was a company last year called NAT that was looking for flax acres, and it was for fiber flax, and they left many growers hanging with not very friendly straw sitting in their fields, and I am one of them. The flax straw, I should say, is impossible to do anything with. It's basically like trying to run cotton thread through a piece of farm equipment, and it just balls up, and it's very hard on equipment. So I would just like to give you that information. I know Russ Carroll had talked about earlier that flax was a viable alternative crop, and it is not. Canola would be a much better alternative because of its unlimited market. And for that reason, I urge you not to move House Bill 2427.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Chairman Witt, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great.
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, my name is Dean Freeborn. We farm in the Rickrell area and fairly diversified in several different things along with some livestock. One thing that I did want to point out right off the bat is we were part of OSU studies for 2 years. We did not have any freeze-out damage. The acreage and the pounds that came off of our fields were the fields in total, and the test strips were the total test strips that they laid out. So there was some that was damaged, I think, the year before because it was held up and planted too late. But you can have that with a lot of things. I've planted a lot of things over the last 40-some years, and things haven't worked out quite right. And if they tell you that every time you plant clover or some of the other vegetable crops in the fall and then they don't have some winter kill, why, somebody's not being real truthful to you. So the 2 years that we had it in those trials, why, it was corner to corner and acre to acre, and the pounds that came off of it are the pounds that came off of it. Just four fairly quick things is we grew canola in the 80s, and to my surprise, why the neighbors, less than a half mile away, why they had been growing sugar beets and were growing sugar beets those 2 years that we were growing canola. And the neighbor to my south, which would have been even closer to them, had a field of canola too. And so, you know, don't know exactly what's changed, but it seems like something's changed. We grow primarily grass seed, and that's where we would be using this as a rotation in our fields. It's very easy to control, to get rid of. It's easier than turnips and radish. We continue to grow some turnips, and they are much harder to control, and I think probably the main reason is because of the deep, big root system or the big bulb, and also probably because of the hard seeds that's in it, where canola lacks that. Like I say, we've followed it with grass seed, and as been stated before, why we have some really good results in that following year crop, not just in growing the canola itself. You ask Representative Witz subsidies. It's, and somebody can tell me here if I'm wrong, and it won't be the first time, but I believe that the USDA is subsidizing the end user of a lot of the tillage radish back in the Midwest. So is that helping to increase the price of that? Because when they're buying it and using it for a cover crop, why, they're getting paid a subsidy by the government. So, you know, it's not our plan to use anything because, as been stated before, we're going for the oil side of it. The other thing that I want to just point out real quickly is we bought seed. They talk about contamination being a big problem, which it can be, it is with anything. We bought seed stock last spring, planted two fields of tall fescue. They ended up with orchard grass in the seed stock. And so for a valley that prides itself in pristine crops and growing things, why, we bought seed stock and it's got orchard grass. So in my mind, why there's not many acres of orchard grass less being grown in the valley, from what we've been going through for the last few days, spraying orchard grass out plant by plant, three rows at a time, and sometimes two row, I'd propose that we ban orchard grass in the valley because it's nothing but a contaminant to tall fescue and to perennial ryegrass and other grasses. So if you want to go down that road, you know, I'm ready to start because it's doing nothing but costing us money because of that problem.
Thank you very much, Dean. Appreciate your testimony.
Any questions, why?
Sure. Questions for Mr. Parker or Freeborn? Not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony. Thanks for coming out tonight. Okay. And Steve Domagala, Anthony Boutard, and Dave Notzigler.
Mr. Domagala was not able to come back tonight.
Okay.
Is Hank still on the phone? He called
back. Hank, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
All right. I'll tell you what. I'm going to give the thank you very much. Appreciate that. Hank, would you like to comment here first?
There all night.
Yes. I'll be brief so that we can get back to the people who are testifying in the room.
Thank you.
So my name is Hank Keough. My farm is called Evoca Farm. I grow specialty vegetable seeds for Wild Garden Seeds in Philomath. I live in Corrales. And I would like to make my testimony from the perspective of a young farmer entering this business of seed farming. When I was born and raised in the Willamette Valley in Corrales, and I intend to be a farmer in that region for the rest of my professional life. So I have 5 points that I'd like to touch on. This bill, I support this House Bill 2427, and I think it's important that the legislature act on it because the ODA has done its best to handle this, but with respect to their work, this question of canola in the Willamette Valley has implications that, as we've seen earlier in the day, are worldwide, have worldwide consequences. And I think it's up to the legislature to make a decision on behalf of the citizens of Oregon. Number two, Representative Witt, you asked Carol Mallory Smith earlier for examples of peer-reviewed scientific papers that might help you come to a decision. I've emailed your secretary some examples of those that you may find helpful. Number three, there's really no coexistence. We've been talking about this coexistence issue, and seed farmers are so focused on seed purity and quality. It's not like mixing two kinds of brassica seeds. It's actual cross-pollination that's happening. So as we heard from the gentleman from Japan earlier this morning, our seed is not the cheapest, but it's the highest quality in the world, and his company is willing to pay for it. And I think we should take a lot of example from the rest of the world, such as France and Australia, where where canola has come in exactly the same situation and pushed out specialty seeds, and now those countries buy seed from the Willamette Valley. So, in the words of one executive, you there in Oregon have yourselves a jewel. Don't blow it. Lastly, the sunset clause is not that great of an idea. 6 years from now, we'll only kick this can down the road. The science probably won't change that much. Biology is not going to change. 6 years from now, we'll be back at the same table with the same people talking about the same thing. Meanwhile, uncertainty about the future of this industry will cripple the growth of this seed industry.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Keough. I appreciate your testimony very much. Please feel free to stay there with us, or if you need to leave, it's your choice, sir. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Okay. Bye.
Bye now. Gentlemen, welcome.
My name is Dave Nofziger. I farm down in the Albany area. I farm a lot of grass seed. Grass seed-wise, I've successfully used rotations. I've used wheat, Metafoam, and mustard as my rotation. I've been very successful at that. I also grow a very small number of specialty seeds, vegetable seeds. That's the only ground I have that's irrigatable. And my concern there is I've had customers from around the world tell me that if this canola is grown here, they will not be here, and long term I won't be growing these crops. So that would be my concern. And that's it.
Thank you very much. Very direct, very to the point. Appreciate your brevity, sir. Thank you.
Chair Witten, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony Buttard. I live in Gaston, Oregon. I'm testing in support of House Bill 2427. My wife and I have a certified organic farm, market farm, bridging Yamhill, Washington counties. We grow a wide range of crops, including Chinese cabbages, turnips, various radishes, rutabagas, kales, and mustards. Because it's difficult to find high-quality organic seed from these and many of the crops, we produce a significant quantity of seed on our farm. Under our organic farm, we produce seed for approximately 35 plant varieties on farm. We also rely on seed from other Willamette Valley growers to fill in the holes where we can't do it successfully because of the cross-pollination issues, which are huge. Balancing the pollination issues is always a challenge. Just coming down this afternoon, or this morning, I didn't see much. It was wet and rainy. But this morning, you come down the valley, and my old boss used to say, look to your left, and you'll see the Cascades, look to your right, and you see the Coast Range. It's really quite a remarkable place where you can see exactly how this valley, which contains over 3 million people, three big metropolitan areas, and some of the best farmland in the world. And we're hemmed in, and you can look to right and look to the left and see the boundaries of this valley. It's quite amazing. And I would urge you to see, that's what makes it unique. That's what provides that barrier and allows the seeds industry to work here. And if you sit there and just sort of look at it and say, well, this little pond here, if we just pollute the edges, everything's going to be all right. I would say, look, I've been battling teasel. I've been battling tansy ragwort. I battle Himalayan blackberries. Plants move with amazing speed and alacrity. They like to move. That's what they do. They're specialized. They don't sit. The idea of a potted plant is not true. So I just sort of want to underscore that. This morning, Dr. Kobo also made a remark about coexistence in Secretary Tom Vilsack. She mentioned that it had to do with the coexistence between organic growers and conventional growers, so-called conventional growers. I am surrounded by conventional growers. We coexist very well. In fact, Nellie McAdams is on my southern boundary. I coexist with seed growers, conventional growers, and use a lot of sprays. We know each other. We keep each other apprised of what we're doing. The issue that Secretary Vilsack is dealing with has to do with genetic modified contamination, and it has to do with both conventional growers and organic growers who fear the loss of market value. And I think there's a similar situation happening in the valley here. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you. Good day.
Thank you very much. Any questions, committee members? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Committee members, we have two panels left here. So if folks can hang in here, we're going to try and get you out. Representative Krieger, I know that you may have something else going on this evening, and if you need to leave, please feel free. The same goes for anyone else on the committee. I'm going to call up next, please, Stacy Phillips, Neil Lucht, and Steve Frischweiler. Good evening, gentlemen. Please proceed.
Howdy. I'm Stacy Phillips with Oregon Right to Know Petition Organizers. I'm here in support of this bill. Everything that's been covered pretty much covers most of the research that I've done on this subject. I just would like you to know that I've read the amendment to it, too, and we're behind you on this. We'd like to see it get to the floor and get to a vote. We have a very precious resource here in the state. We need to protect it. If we don't, if we fail on this, well, it's not going to be good for anybody in the valley, and it'll probably be detrimental to some other folks in the world. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next.
Good evening, Representative Witt and the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Neil Luke. A graduate of Oregon State University in 1983 in horticultural science. My wife and I started a small business called Northwest Transplants in 1990, primarily to serve the transplant seedling needs of the vegetable industry and commercial agriculture. So it's a specialized nursery focusing in a little bit of a different market. Approximately to date, of our $2 million in sales, over 85% of it is in fresh vegetable and specialty seed industries. So an impact like this is pretty important to my, according to Obamacare, 20 full-time equivalent employees, and the concern that they have over impacts on those two industries specifically. I want to bring up something in agreeing with both Oregon State University this morning and Director Koba about what we know to be facts about this, and that is the impact on pest and disease. Both of those folks stated that there will be an increase in the pest and disease pressure with increased acres of canola. With that known, we're going to be looking at an impact industry-wide on increased pesticide use to circumvent that. Our operation sits right on that fuzzy, depending on which way the bee flies, border of that purple zone. I have customers in the specialty seed industry that are quite concerned, not just in the Willamette Valley and in Western Washington and the Eastern Basins, that are like, well, we're going to have to really closely monitor what's going on right around you with this canola thing. I really encourage you to please vote in favor and bring to the floor House Bill 2427. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good evening. My name is Steve Frischweiler. I'm the owner of a small vegetable seed production company called Orca Seed Production. We also do a little bit of flower seed production. I'm in favor of this bill because of my main fear is the loss of high-value crops that are very profitable for my company and for my growers that I contract with. And also the loss of these crops will impact the custom seed cleaner I use, the seed testing companies I use, the transplant company I use, and other suppliers, for instance, bags and drywall bins and whatnot. I guess on the other hand, I'd be facetious. If I lose these contracts, I won't have to pay ODA for field inspections and some of the certificates that are required for export. So. But the risk of losing the acreage is real. I can remember a production, a visitor from France, it was in the production side of the company there that was visiting, and he was telling me about their radish seed production over there, which we've we've inherited because of all the problems that they've had. And he talks about the beetles coming out of the canola, and they'd go out in the morning and the crop was black with these beetles, and they'd spray it and go out the next morning and the crop was black again. And so that drove their, they had to quit producing in that area. Anyway, this is, they just had to, my other concern, canola, at one point it sounded like if there was canola, it was going to be conventional, not GM. Now the ODA has kind of changed their tune in saying that they won't control that anymore, that USDA has deregulated that, and so it's probable that GM canola would be here. That's also a problem for my customers. If we have contamination from canola and it's GM canola, it's a double hit. So I urge you to pass this measure. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Many members, anything here? Mr. Frischweiler, I'm going to ask you something that's probably obvious, but I'm going to ask it so that we have it on record. You mentioned that this the contamination could potentially hurt the seed processors, and I may be using the wrong terminology here, but could you explain briefly how that would occur?
Saying that if we lose these high-value crops, if they're not produced in our area anymore, it will cut back on our usage of custom seed cleaners and the amount of business that we do with them.
And what would you expect would happen to the seed cleaners if there were contamination?
If our crop is found to be contaminated, it's rejected. It's written in the contract. There's no noxious. Of course, the canola would be considered a noxious weed in our contract. So it's rejected. Nobody gets any money from it.
I see.
We would probably still owe the seed cleaner, of course.
Yes.
But we would not realize any income from that crop. Neither would our grower.
All right.
Right.
Very good. Thank you, gentlemen, very, very much. Appreciate your testimony. With that, I'm going to call up, please, Rebecca Landis, Dan Nelson, Craig Huffman. And is there a M. Iverson this evening? Okay.
He's not here.
Okay. I'll ask Mr. Iverson to come up, too, please. And committee members, this is the this completes the list of folks who are signed up.
Mr. Chairman Witt, committee members, I'm Mike Iverson. I own Aurora Farms in Aurora, Oregon, a 200-acre all-fresh market vegetable farm. I'm a member and past president of the Oregon Fresh Market Growers Association. I'm a board member of OFS, a board member of the Clackamas County Farm Bureau, and a member of Friends of Family Farmers. So between going to meetings, we raise over a dozen different kinds of fresh market vegetables for the West Coast market, up Seattle, over into Idaho, Montana, down into California, San Francisco market, and the majority stays right here in Oregon. There's probably five or six legitimate, I would say, brassica growers in the Northwest here. And maybe we could add one or two in California, but so north of the Mexican border, there's probably less than a dozen growers producing all the radishes and turnips and rutabagas for probably half the United States. So we are all concerned about, we will be definitely affected by the disease and especially pest hit that we will take from uncontrolled pesticide or pest influences from a canola population in the valley here. We also buy these very expensive seeds from these guys behind me, and I hate to see what would happen if everybody checks out of here and goes someplace else because the cost is going to go up. From the outset, we've all, our membership, our association, has recognized the threat, and this new mandate of coexistence that is now being touted will put almost every other ag production sector in jeopardy in the valley. And considering the diversity of crops we have in this valley, as you've heard previously, we've been essentially free of major conflicts in the 32 years that I've put in here as a grower. Prior to that, I was 15 years a production manager in the Salinas Valley in California and a licensed pest control advisor. So I was paid a lot of money to recognize threats when I see one. So I recognize this is a threat. We've been part of the advisory committee early on when people were still trying to talk to see if there was any way to get along, but it dead-ended and we didn't get invited to further meetings. So after you've heard about what's happened elsewhere in the world, why would we dare think that we could avoid the same crash happening here to us? I think that we can't let the genie out of the bottle. I've used that term before, and that's kind of how I look at it, that over time, we will all pay a steep price, and it will filter down through many, many different industries we all spend a lot of money with here. I have a near $700,000 a year labor bill. It affects a lot of people's livelihoods. So I would just go to say that in conclusion, our $30 million fresh vegetable industry, we represent a lot of large input production inputs, many jobs, and the multiplying effect on the state economy. I and many growers stand opposed to the latest ill-advised and carelessly administered, we feel, administrative rule, which was accomplished with little transparency. We strongly support HB 2427 and bring it to the floor, and the wise efforts contained in that bill to preserve and protect the vital agricultural interests in the Willamette Valley from an unnecessary species introduction. And maybe I can answer questions.
Thank you, Mr.
I did
Robinson.
It on time.
Right on time. Yeah. Questions or comments for this witness? I'm not seeing any. Sir, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, gentlemen.
You overwhelmed us with your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify this evening on House Bill 2427? Sir?
Sign up.
You may come forward.
Probably not saving the best for last, but I'll give it a try.
All right.
Good evening, Chairman Witt and committee members. I appreciate, and I think everybody does here tonight, you folks reconvening, because it's a very important issue, obviously, to all of us. My name is Gary Vochter, and my wife and I have farmed in the St. Paul area for 31 years. I'm a third-generation farmer. And I'd like to emphasize the crops I do raise is grass seed, specialty seeds, wheats and clovers, because this morning it really kind of bothered me in other testimonies that it's pushed that grass seed growers are pushing for canola. So some are and some aren't. You've heard that in the testimony today. We've invested a lot of money over the years to be able to raise these specialty seed crops, especially like irrigation systems. I did that in the 90s. Probably hundreds of thousands of dollars I've invested in that, so I could diversify my operation. Seed companies have invested a lot of money in their infrastructures, and I think probably one of the most important things they've invested in is years of developing relationships with other companies. Obviously, a man coming from Japan is trying to really prove a point how important that is. If canola, I feel, is canola is allowed in the Willamette Valley, the special seed industry will be greatly affected, if not eliminated. There's no question that there will be a greater risk of contamination, cross-pollination, and it's not just wind, it's things like birds just carrying, making nests, winds, bee movement, seed escaping from equipment, from trucks. I don't think 3M can make enough duct tape to seal up a farm truck or a combine. 31 years, I've grown a lot of different crops, and I've blown a lot of combines out. And I've had it more than one time where lots of times we're raising crimson clover, which is usually our first crop we harvest. Mm-hmm. And I'm blowing that combine out after probably 10 to 15 cleanouts a year. And I'll find a crimson clover seed stuck in a chain. So cleaning a piece of equipment 100% is virtually impossible. One thing about escaping, there's a perfect example of, if you folks remember the Roundup Ready bentgrass experiment they had over in Central Oregon, it was under these same parameters that they were trying to, because they tried to raise it here in the valley and nobody would want to do it. So they took it over, I believe, in the Madras area, tried to isolate a field. In 1 year, the Roundup Ready bentgrass escaped that area. And there's been articles in the Capital Press. I think it's been contaminated the national forest. It was a disaster. And they tried to really take care of that. Well, I'm in a hurry here. I realize, even though our valley is not very big, every area has challenges. I realize I feel sorry for the people up in the hills that can't irrigate and stuff. But I feel like almost in a way I'm kind of punished if you're working around that, because in the St. Paul area, we have very high valuable ground that comes at a cost. And we push hard and work hard to make a good income. Relating to what Garth says, and if I can throw this out.
Gary, if you could wrap it up,
real
please.
Quick. The income on our farm, I just did the last 2 years, did it real quick last night. 40% of our gross income came off of 28% of the acres we farm. In 2011, 30% of our gross income came off of 24% of our ground. So it's obviously it's high value, and it's important to us. And I ask you to support this House bill.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for Mr. Vochter? I'm not seeing any. Sir, you...
Go ahead and finish. I did sign up to speak, and I didn't have opportunities. So.
Okay, we must have missed you on the list. Come on forward, please. One other person that we've missed. Is there anyone else in the audience tonight that wishes to testify? Sir, come on forward, please. Last and final call. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Not all night, anyways. All right. Gentlemen, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for letting me speak. My name is Tony Shepard. I'm a crop consultant. I live in Silverton, Oregon. I work with conventional crops and organic crops. I've been in agriculture for over 35 years in many different capacities. One of the things that I remember in one of my first classes I had in agriculture, I have a degree in bachelor of science in horticulture and also in business. First class, weed science. First day of class, they taught us, what's a weed? Well, the definition of a weed is something, a plant that's not planted in the right place. You plant a tomato field in a cornfield, the tomato plant's a weed. If you have a cornfield and vice versa, my point is, if you plant canola in the Willamette Valley, that's a weed. If you plant it in North Dakota, and you plant a specialty seed crop in North Dakota, that's probably a weed over there. North Dakota is a great place to grow canola. We have a very unique agricultural system here. The Willamette Valley is all one part of one watershed. It's one climatic zone. And the potential for contamination and to ruin a very good growing area for specialty seed crops is certainly a problem. I really feel that there's other alternative crops that can be grown. I live in the Silverton Hills area, and someday in 20 years that'll probably all be wine grapes. There's a good alternative crop. Doesn't need to be watered, and those are great grounds for it. So that's just one suggestion, but I understand the need for alternative crops, but I don't think canola is probably a good choice. I think it's a very low-value crop. It's great in North Dakota. But we've got much better things to grow here in this very unique climatical system here in the Willamette Valley.
Thank you very much. And sir, I apologize. My attention was diverted, and I didn't catch your name.
Tony Shepard.
Tony Shepard. Thank you very much. Who's next?
You could have told me they put it in their dumpster. Right.
Thank you. I'm Ted Hake, production manager for Universal Seed Company. This past year, I was the president of Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association, and Greg Loberg and I were asked to serve on one of the canola advisory committees with ODA. One thing that's been mentioned several times, I've heard in other testimony, is that this was this current rule was a collaborative effort. When in fact, none of our concerns about the dangers that we've seen in Europe with canola and trying to fit it in with specialty crops were addressed. So we finally asked to have our name removed from that because we didn't want to give the appearance of supporting a rule that we feel is a great danger to our industry based on what's happened elsewhere in the world, which is why we've rallied our troops and we're pestering all of you late at night now. Based on what's happened elsewhere in the world, we see a very real danger with bringing canola into the valley. We're entirely in favor and think that the best, I don't remember the word someone used, coexistence
mm-hmm.
that we can find with canola is growing canola outside of the Willamette Valley in climates here in Oregon. They're very well suited to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good evening. My name's Kevin Lowe.
Hello, Kevin.
I own and operate Triangle Farms with my family. I'm outside the zone, so I'm in the canola growing zone.
Mm-hmm.
I've been growing specialist seed for over 30 years. We produce, last year we produced over 200 different crops. I can see this as being a threat to what we do. 25 years ago in our area, there was canola grown. We watched the volunteers on the neighbor's property for the next 10 years. Seen these volunteers, so I know for a fact I have seen the problems. What I see out of this is if we make a mistake here and let this happen, how are we going to fix it? We need to be very careful with what we do here because there's no reversing this once we do it. The damage will be done. So we need to take a real close look at this based off of previous history. And as far as it being a restriction in the valley, it has been restricted. It's not a crop that we're taking away from growers. It was never there in the first place in the valley. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything for this panel, committee members?
Sure.
Yes, Representative Clement.
Really, for the whole room, can we at least all admit that the Oregon State is superior to the U of O?
Hey. Except for the chair, I think, maybe. Sorry about that. Forgot about that. Sorry about that.
Representative Clem.
Yeah, they're all dead. All my bills are dead.
It was recently St. Patrick's Day, Representative Clem Green. So, with that, gentlemen, thank you so very, very much for your testimony. I want to give the committee members an opportunity to make any comments before I close the public hearing, if you wish to do so. We've had over 4 hours of testimony on House Bill 2427 at this point. I realize that we're all dog tired, but also want to give you the opportunity to make a comment should you choose to do so. Anything here? All right. With that, I want to... you wore us down is what you did. I want to urge the committee members to please share any comments or concerns that you may have with Vice Chairs Esquivel and McEwen. I am going to be meeting with both of them, and we're going to decide where we go from here on this bill. So in order for the three of us to be able to make that kind of decision, I'm going to need your input, so please share that with them. And with that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2427. Committee members, anything for the good of the order? Not seeing anything. Folks, if you enjoyed the hearing on canola, this was a warm-up. Wait till you hear about the coming events. Elizabeth?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on Thursday, March 21st at 8 a.m. in Hearing Room D. There will be a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2530, which prohibits the importation of genetically engineered fish into this state. There will also be public hearings on House Bill 2175, House Bill 2532, and House Bill 3177. The first two bills make foods that contain or are produced using genetically engineered materials subject to labeling requirements. And the third bill requires signage in areas where genetically engineered fish are sold, displayed for sale, or offered for sale at retail for human consumption.
And with that, folks, back here Thursday morning, 8 a.m., we stand adjourned. Thank you all very, very much.